Chapter 37. A wife. A kindness to her. Ah, yes. A kindness to her to release her altogether. But I don't like the sound of it. I can forgive, Sue. No, no. You can't have me back now. I have been so wicked as to do what I have done. There had arisen in Sue's face that incipient fright which showed itself whenever he changed from friend to husband, and which made her adopt any line of defense against marital feeling in him. I must go now. I'll come again, may I? I don't ask you to go, even now. I ask you to stay. I thank you, Richard, but I must. As you are not so ill as I thought, I cannot stay. She's his from lips to heel, said Phillotson, but so faintly that in closing the door she did not hear it. The dread of a reactionary change in the schoolmaster's sentiments, coupled, perhaps, with a faint sham of fussedness at letting even him know what a slipshod lack of thoroughness, from a man's point of view, characterized her transferred allegiance, prevented her telling him of her, thus far, incomplete relations with Jude. And Phillotson lay writhing like a man in hell as he pictured the prettily dressed, maddening compound of sympathy and averseness who bore his name, returning impatiently to the home of her lover. Gillingham was so interested in Phillotson's affairs, and so seriously concerned about him, that he walked up the hillside to Shaston 2 or 3 times a week, although, there and back, it was a journey of 9 miles, which had to be performed between tea and supper, after a hard day's work in school. When he called on the next occasion after Sue's visit, his friend was downstairs, and Gillingham noticed that his restless mood had been supplanted by a more fixed and composed one. She's been here since you called last, said Phillotson. Not Mrs. Phillotson? Yes. Ah, you have made it up? No. She just came, patted my pillow with her little white hand, played the thoughtful nurse for half an hour, and went away. Well, I'm hanged. A little hussy. What do you say? Oh, nothing. What do you mean? I mean, what a tantalizing, capricious little woman. If she were not your wife, she is not. She's another man's except in name and law. And I have been thinking it was suggested to me by a conversation I had with her that, in kindness to her, I ought to dissolve the legal tie altogether. Which, singularly enough, I think I can do, now as he has been back, and refused my request to stay, after I said I had forgiven her. I believe that fact would afford me opportunity of doing it, though I did not see it at the moment. What's the use of keeping her chained onto me, if she doesn't belong to me? I know I feel absolutely certain that she would welcome my taking such a step as the greatest charity to her. For though as a fellow creature she sympathizes with, and pities me, and even weeps for me, as a husband she cannot endure me, she loathes me, there's no use in mincing words, she loathes me, and my only manly, and dignified, and merciful course is to complete what I have begun. And for worldly reasons too, it will be better for her to be independent. I have hopelessly ruined my prospects, because of my decision, as to what was best for us, though she does not know it. I see only dire poverty ahead from my feet to the grave, for I can be accepted as teacher no more. I shall probably have enough to do to make both ends meet during the remainder of my life, now my occupation's gone, and I shall be better able to bear it alone. I may as well tell you that what has suggested my letting her go is some news she brought me, the news that Folly is doing the same. Oh, he had a spouse too? A queer couple, these lovers. Well, I don't want your opinion on that. What I was going to say is that my liberating her can do her no possible harm, and will open up a chance of happiness for her which as he has never dreamt of hitherto. For then they'll be able to marry, as they ought to have done at first. Gillingham did not hurry to reply. May disagree with your motive, he said gently, for he respected views he could not share. But I think you are right in your determination, if you can carry it out. I doubt, however, if you can. Part 5, at Aldbrickham and elsewhere, high aerial part, and all the fiery parts which are mingled in thee, though by nature they have an upward tendency, still in obedience to the disposition of the universe they are overpowered here in the compound mass the body. M. Antoninus Long. I. How Gillingham's doubts were disposed of will most quickly appear, by passing over the series of dreary months, and incidents that followed the events of the last chapter, and coming on to a Sunday in the February of the year following. Sue and Jude were living in Elbrickham, in precisely the same relations that they had established between themselves when she left Shaston to join him the year before. The proceedings in the law courts had reached their consciousness, but as a distant sound and an occasional missive which they hardly understood. They had met, as usual, to breakfast together in the little house with Jude's name on it, that he had taken at £15 a year, with £3.10 extra for rates and taxes, and furnished with his aunt's ancient and lumbering goods, which had cost him about their full value, to bring all the way from Marygreen. Sue kept house, and managed everything. As he entered the room this morning, Sue held up a letter she had just received. Well, and what is it about? He said after kissing her. That the decree Nicaea in the case of Phillotson versus Phillotson and Folly, pronounced 6 months ago, has just been made absolute. Ah, said Jude, as he sat down. The same concluding incident in Jude's suit against Arabella had occurred about a month or two earlier. Both cases had been too insignificant to be reported in the papers, further than by name in a long list of other undefended cases. Now then, Sue, at any rate, you can do what you like. He looked at his sweetheart curiously. Are we, you and I, just as free now, as if we had never married at all? Just as free, except, I believe, that a clergyman may object personally to remarry you, and hand the job on to somebody else. But I wonder, do you think it is really so with us? I know it is generally. But I have an uncomfortable feeling that my freedom has been obtained under false pretenses. How? Well, if the truth about us had been known, the decree wouldn't have been pronounced. It is only, is it, because we have made no defense, and have led them into a false supposition? Therefore is my freedom lawful, however proper it may be. Well, why did you let it be under false pretenses? You have only yourself to blame, he said mischievously. Jude, don't. You ought not to be touchy about that still. You must take me as I am. Very well, darling. So I will. Perhaps you were right. As to your question, we were not obliged to prove anything. That was their business. Anyhow, we are living together. Yes. Though not in their sense. One thing is certain, that however the decree may be brought about, a marriage is dissolved when it is dissolved. There is this advantage in being poor, obscure people like us, that these things are done for us in a rough and ready fashion. It was the same with me and Arabella. I was afraid her criminal second marriage would have been discovered, and she punished. But nobody took any interest in her, nobody inquired, nobody suspected it. If we'd been patented nobilities, we should have had infinite trouble, and days and weeks would have been spent in investigations. By degrees Sue acquired her lover's cheerfulness at the sense of freedom, and proposed that they should take a walk in the fields, even if they had to put up with a cold dinner on account of it. Jude agreed, and Sue went upstairs and prepared to start, putting on a joyful colored gown in observance of her liberty, seeing which Jude put on a lighter tie. Now we'll strut arm and arm, he said, like any other engaged couple. We've a legal right to. They rambled out of the town, and along a path over the low-lying lands that bordered it, though these were frosty now, and the extensive seed fields were bare of color and produce. The pair, however, were so absorbed in their own situation, that their surroundings were little in their consciousness. Well, my dearest, the result of all this is that we can marry after a decent interval. Yes, I suppose we can, said Sue, without enthusiasm. And aren't we going to? I don't like to say no, dear Jude, but I feel just the same about it now as I have done all along. I have just the same dreadless and iron contract should extinguish your tenderness for me, and mine for you, as it did between our unfortunate parents. Still, what can we do? I do love you, as you know, Sue. I know it abundantly. But I think I would much rather go on living always as lovers, as we are living now, and only meeting by day. It is so much sweeter for the woman at least, and when she is sure of the man. And henceforward we need be so particular as we have been about appearances. Our experiences of matrimony with others have not been encouraging, I own, said he with some gloom, either owing to our own dissatisfied, unpractical natures, or by our misfortune. But we two should be two dissatisfied ones linked together, which would be twice as bad as before. I think I should begin to be afraid of you, Jude, the moment you had contracted to cherish me under a government stamp, and I was licensed to be loved on the premises by you. Ugh, how horrible and sordid. Although, as you are, free, I trust you more than any other man in the world. No, no, don't say I should change, he expostulated. Yet there was misgiving in his own voice also. Apart from ourselves, and our unhappy peculiarities, it is foreign to a man's nature to go on loving a person when he is told that he must and shall be that person's lover. There would be a much likelier chance of his doing it if he were told not to love. If the marriage ceremony consisted in an oath and signed contract between the parties to cease loving from that day forward, in consideration of personal possession being given, and to avoid each other's society as much as possible in public, there would be more loving couples than there are now. Fancy the secret meetings between the perjuring husband and wife, the denials of having seen each other, the clambering in at bedroom windows, and the hiding in closets. There'd be little cooling then. Yes, but admitting this, or something like it, to be true, you are not the only one in the world to see it, dear little Sue. People go on marrying because they can't resist natural forces, although many of them may know perfectly well that they are possibly buying a month's pleasure with a life's discomfort. No doubt my father and mother, and your father and mother, saw it, if they at all, resembled us in habits of observation. But then they went and married just the same, because they had ordinary passions. But you, Sue, are such a phantasmal, bodiless creature, one who, if you'll allow me to say it, has so little animal passion in you, that you can act upon reason in the matter, when we poor unfortunate wretches of grosser substance can't. Well, she sighed, you've owned that it would probably end in misery for us. And I am not so exceptional a woman as you think. Fewer women like marriage than you suppose, only they enter into it for the dignity it is assumed to confer, and the social advantages it gains them sometimes a dignity and an advantage that I am quite willing to do without. Jude fell back upon his old complaint that, intimate as they were, he had never once had from her an honest, candid declaration that she loved, or could love him. Really fear sometimes that you cannot, he said, with a dubiousness approaching anger. And you are so reticent. I know that women are taught by other women that they must never admit the full truth to a man. But the highest form of affection is based on full sincerity on both sides. Not being men, these women don't know that in looking back on those he has had tender relations with, a man's heart returns closest to her who was the soul of truth in her conduct. The better class of man, even if caught by airy affectations of dodging and parrying, is not retained by them. A nemesis attends the woman who plays the game of elusiveness too often, in the utter contempt for her that, sooner or later, her old admirers feel, under which they allow her to go unlamented to her grave. Sue, who was regarding the distance, had acquired a guilty look, and she suddenly replied in a tragic voice, "Don't think I like you today so well as I did, Jude. Don't you? Why? Oh, well, you are not nice to ceremony, though I suppose I am so bad and worthless that I deserve the utmost rigor of lecturing. No, you are not bad. You are a dear. but as slippery as an eel when I want to get a confession from you. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.